This is podcast number 112 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm talking about Patrick Henry. I don't know that we think much about what stirs our hearts, but as I learn more about America's fight for independence, I see the languages of the heart at work. One of the most powerful ways to reach the heart is a play. It's a story played out before our eyes, and we're drawn into it in a way that we're almost living the events with the actors. I read somewhere that one of the most popular plays at the time of the Revolution was written by Addison and was based on one of Plutarch's lives, Cato, which we'll read more about in month 4. The message of this play was that liberty was worth dying for. Some of our early founders watched it numerous times, and it is said that Washington commissioned the play to be performed at Valley Forge. I have to wonder if Patrick Henry and Nathan Hale watched it, as they gave us the two most often quoted phrases of the time, "Give me liberty or give me death," and "I only regret that I have but one life to give to my country." In this podcast, I want to turn to Patrick Henry, my neighbor. I've spent the last couple of 4th of Julys at his beautiful farm up the road, and he always comes and shares the powerful speech that moved men's hearts forward at a time when their reluctance was paralyzing their actions. The story I'm sharing today is from a book called Historic Americans by Elbridge S. Brooks, and if you like his storytelling style, you might want to check it out for stories on other early patriots like Benjamin Franklin, James Otis, Samuel Adams, and Thomas Jefferson. Here's the story. A king, by annulling or disallowing acts of so salutary a measure, from being the father of his people, degenerates into a tyrant and forfeits all right to his subjects' obedience. The young lawyer paused for an instant, but in that instant men had sprung to their feet. "Treason! Treason!" came the cry from different parts of the crowded courtroom, and Mr. Lyons, the opposing counsel, appealed hotly to the bench where sat the young lawyer's own father as presiding justice. "Treason! The gentleman has spoken treason," he cried. "Will your worships listen to that without showing your disapproval?" Their worships said nothing. Instead, they sat mute and spellbound under the surprising flow of eloquence from the lips of one whom they had considered neither orator, pleader, nor lawyer, but who now, at one bound and by a sudden burst of eloquence, sprang into popularity, fame, and leadership. The place was the stuffy little courthouse in the county seat of Hanover in the colony of Virginia. The time was the first day of December, 1763. The man was Patrick Henry. He was arguing on the wrong side of an important case in which both law and precedent were absolutely against him. It was a case of taxes in which the council of the King of England had deliberately and contemptuously set aside a law made by the colony. In this case, the king's council was right as to judgment, but wrong as to action. The law it disallowed was an unjust one, but the high-handed manner in which king and council overruled and annulled it was not to be borne by the liberty and justice-loving colonists who had enacted it. That was the way in which the matter appeared to Patrick Henry, when, as a forlorn hope, he took up a case which other lawyers would not touch. "The King of England has no right to meddle in the lawmaking of this colony. Virginia can look out for herself," he said, and in this spirit he defended a losing case and by his eloquence, earnestness, and argument overruled the judgment of the court, turned a defeat into victory, and won the case he had championed for his clients, the people. This celebrated case, known in American history as the Parson's Cause, made the name and established the fame of Patrick Henry as a resistless pleader and an impassioned orator. Up to that date, he had not been a success. The son of a Virginia gentleman of small means, young Patrick Henry was left to himself for amusement and education, obtaining a good deal more of the first than of the second. He was a careless, happy-go-lucky country boy of the pleasant region of Middle Virginia, loving hunting and fishing more than study and loafing more than books, never succeeding at anything, and sticking to nothing long. He failed as a farmer, failed in business, married a tavern keeper's daughter when he had nothing on which to support her, and, failing at everything else, hastily concluded to try the law. He failed even in his examinations for that, and was only admitted to the bar through the good nature of one of the examining lawyers, and because of his own success at arguing the other out of a careless indifference. Such a man does not seem fitted to champion a great cause or teach new ideas to an energetic people, but something above the opportunity that lay beneath the parson's cause inspired and held young Henry. It gave him an earnestness that surprised and an eloquence that electrified his hearers. And those who hung their heads for shame when Patrick Henry began to speak lifted him from the floor as he proceeded and bore him out on their shoulders when he had concluded. From that day, success and fame were his. He sprang into instant popularity as the people's champion. Practice as a lawyer flowed in upon him. He gained advancement in his own colony and power as a politician. He turned over a new leaf. He was no longer shiftless or unsteady. Popularity brought him business, and business brought him money. As a result, he became an influential country gentleman with an estate of his own, with admirers and supporters throughout Virginia, and with the ability to gratify his leanings towards political preferment that speedily gave him position and importance. He was elected a member of the Virginia House of Burgesses, or legislature. He became a political leader in Virginia and was sent as a delegate to the First and Second Continental Congresses, was the first commander of Virginia's Revolutionary Army, and was 3 times governor of Virginia. His fame spread throughout the land, and any office in the gift of the new nation might have been his had he cared to accept it. But he wished for no office. He declined to serve as member of the Constitutional Convention, as United States Senator, as Secretary of State, as Governor of Virginia for the 4th time, as Chief Justice of the United States, as Ambassador to France, and as Vice President of the United States. He declined, you see, even more than he accepted office. You know what gave him his greatest fame and led the people of the United States to know, to honor, and to respect him? It was his famous oration in Old St. John's Church in Richmond, an oration that has not yet ceased ringing in the ears of Americans, and which, in certain of its impetuous utterances, has become a part of the proverbs and maxims of the Republic. Let me try to draw for you the picture of that remarkable speech in which he urged the arming of the Virginia militia in resistance to the British authorities. For, as Professor Tyler says, it is chiefly the tradition of that one speech which today keeps alive in millions of American homes the name of Patrick Henry, and which lifts him in the popular faith almost to the rank of some mythical hero of romance. It is a plain and unpretending little church today as it stands almost on the summit of one of beautiful Richmond's sightly hills. Church Hill, it is called, at the corner of Broadway and 24th Street. Small as it is, the church is today much larger than it was on that day in 1775, Thursday, the 23rd of March, when, rising to his feet, in the pew still shown to visitors and marked by a memorial tablet, Patrick Henry threw down the gauntlet to King George and declared war on the haughty prerogative of Great Britain. The Second Revolutionary Convention of Virginia was assembled in that old church on the hill in Richmond. The first convention had met at Williamsburg the year before and had sent to the Continental Congress such representative Virginians as George Washington, Richard Henry Lee, Benjamin Harrison, and Patrick Henry, with others of equal ability, if of less prominence. There, Patrick Henry, as pronounced an advocate of open resistance and organized protest as Samuel Adams of Massachusetts, had advocated a union of all the colonies for mutual protection and defense against the aggressions of England, with equal representation and equal interests for all, saying grandly as he pled for unity, "The distinctions between Virginians, Pennsylvanians, New Yorkers, and New Englands are no more. I am not a Virginian, but an American." and now the Second Revolutionary Congress of Virginia had met to debate upon the question whether Virginia should declare for peace or war. Everywhere throughout the colonies, the people were restless. Everywhere there was talk of resistance, and from Massachusetts Bay to Charleston Harbor, the local military companies were being organized for possible emergencies and drilled to the use of arms. But prudence was keeping men back from act or speech that might be deemed aggressive. Prudence was still holding men loyal to the king. So when the question of arming the militia of Virginia came up in the colonial convention, and Patrick Henry introduced a resolution that this colony be immediately put into a posture of defense and a committee be appointed to prepare a plan for embodying, arming, and disciplining such a number of men as may be sufficient for that purpose, prudence interfered to prevent so menacing a move. The resolution is premature, objected some of the more conservative members. War with Great Britain may come, they said, but it may be prevented. May come, exclaimed Patrick Henry. May come? It has come. And then, rising in his place in that narrow pew in Old St. John's, he broke out into that famous speech which now, as Professor Tyler remarks, fills so great a space in the traditions of revolutionary eloquence. Tall and thin in figure, with stooping shoulders and sallow face, carelessly dressed in his suit of parson's gray, Patrick Henry faced the president of the convention, who sat in the chancel of the church, and began calmly, courteously, and with dignity. "No man, Mr. President," he said, "thinks more highly than I do of the patriotism as well as the abilities of the very honorable gentlemen who have just addressed the House. But different men often see the same subject in different lights, and therefore I hope it will not be thought disrespectful to those gentlemen if, entertaining as I do opinions of a character very opposite to theirs, I should speak forth my sentiments freely and without reserve." Then he flung aside courtesy and calmness. "This is no time for ceremony," he told them hotly. "The question before the House is one of awful moment to the country. For my own part, I consider it as nothing less than a question of freedom or slavery. Should I keep back my opinions at such a time through fear of giving offense? I should consider myself," he declared impressively, "as guilty of treason toward my country, and of an act of disloyalty to the majesty of heaven, which I revere above all earthly kings." Then he began his argument with that sentence which is still as a household word in the mouths of men. "Mr. President, it is natural for men to indulge in the illusions of hope, and showing how under existing circumstances hope was but a false beacon, and experience was the only safe guide, he called attention to the armament of England and demanded, 'I ask, gentlemen, sir, what means this martial array if its purpose be not force us to submission?' Impressively, he showed them that England's display of might was meant for America, sent over to bind and rivet upon us those chains which the British ministry have been so long forging. He demanded how his associates intended to oppose this British tyranny. Argument had failed. Entreaty and supplication were of no avail. Compromise was exhausted. Petitions and remonstrances, supplications and prostrations were alike disregarded. We have been spurned with contempt from the foot of the throne," he said. "There is no longer," he declared, "any room for hope. If we wish to be free, if we wish not basely to abandon the noble struggle in which we have been so long engaged," he paused, and then, as one of his hearers said, with all the calm dignity of Cato addressing the Senate, like a voice from heaven uttering the doom of fate, he added solemnly but decisively, "We must fight. I repeat it, sir, we must fight. An appeal to arms and to the God of hosts is all that is left to us." Then his calmness all gone, his voice deepening and his slender form swayed with the passion of his own determination, he flung himself into that fervent appeal for union resistance that we all know so well. Besides, sir, we shall not fight our battles alone. There is a just God who presides over the destinies of nations, who will raise up friends to fight our battles for us. The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, the active, the brave. It is now too late to retire from the contest. There is no retreat now, but in submission and slavery. Our chains are forged. Their clanking may be heard on the plains of Boston. The war is inevitable. And let it come. I repeat it, sir, let it come. Can you not almost hear that wonderful voice as it makes that terrible invitation with all the force of confident faith and repressed enthusiasm? Can you not almost see that swaying form, those forcible gestures, that face stern with purpose? Old men there were, years after its utterance, who could not forget that tremendous speech, nor how, with their eyes riveted on the speaker, they sat, as one of them expressed it, sick with excitement. And then came that ending, one of those immortal bursts of eloquence, a fitting climax to what had gone before. It is vain, sir, to extenuate the matter. Gentlemen may cry peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war is actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it that gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take. But as for me, give me liberty or give me death. That wonderful speech has lived in men's memories and hearts for over 100 years. For other hundreds it will live as one of the trumpet calls leading men to fight for freedom or to die free men, to stand in that very pew in old St. John's as I have done, and to recall that notable speech thrills and inspires any true American. That speech has made Patrick Henry live forever as America's impassioned orator. But better still, it turned Virginia, as in a flash, for independence and made her stand side by side with Massachusetts, leaders and co-workers in the fight for liberty. How ready Patrick Henry was to live up to his grand principles of liberty or death we may discover in his story. From the convention, he went speedily to the field. He was made Commander-in-Chief of Virginia's Revolutionary Army, as George Washington was of the Continental Forces, and almost the first overt act of the war in Virginia, so Thomas Jefferson declared, was committed by Patrick Henry. With 5,000 hurriedly gathered minutemen, he marched upon the King's Governor, Lord Dunmore, at Williamsburg, and demanded the stolen powder of the province, or reparation for its loss. And the King's Governor wisely judged discretion to be the better part of valor, and sent his receiver general with £330 to pay for the stolen powder. Then he issued a proclamation declaring a certain Patrick Henry an outlaw and rebel. But the people of Virginia hailed the outlaw as their leader, and heaped him with honors in the way of thanks and addresses. There are many points of resemblance in the careers of Samuel Adams and Patrick Henry. Both were architects of ruin, opponents of prerogative, foes to kingly authority. Both led the attack of the people upon British tyranny, and by their matchless labors, with voice or pen, organized revolt, set on foot revolution, and showed the way to liberty and independence. Then, their higher mission accomplished, their work fell into other hands, and they who had been leaders became onlookers and critics. Each one was governor of his native state, and each felt alike the sun of popularity and the gloom of misrepresentation and defeat. Both enjoyed a well-merited old age, though Adams outlived his colleague alike in years and honors. I have told you that Patrick Henry declined more honors than he accepted. One reason was, not that he could not march with the Republic, but because of continued ill health, which so often dulls the edge of energy, makes a man critical, and keeps him dissatisfied. Alike the friend and critic of Washington, Patrick Henry was also friend and critic of the Republic he had helped to found, loving it for its liberty, but despairing sometimes of its future because things were not done as he would like to see them. He retired from public life largely because of criticism, for, you see, there was a great deal of criticism in the air in those early days of the Republic, and criticism of his acts was one thing that Patrick Henry could not stand. Impetuous as James Otis, determined as Samuel Adams, like both those fervent patriots, Patrick Henry chafed under restraint and hated to have his motives called in question. There are, after all, very few such superbly patient, gloriously self-governed men as George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. But impetuosity is sometimes inspiration. This, at least, was one cause of Patrick Henry's eloquence. As an orator, he had remarkable powers, but as a leader, he was often uncertain and sometimes headstrong to his own detriment and his country's peril. But after all, it is as one who moves by the magic of his words that Patrick Henry's claim to remembrance as an historic American chiefly rests. Above everything else, he was an orator, and it is as the orator of resistance, of liberty, and of patriotism that he has our loving and grateful reverence and will be remembered by America forever and ever. His later years were spent in peaceful pursuits upon his beautiful farm at Red Hill near historic Appomattox, and there he died on the 6th of June, 1799, surrounded by loving friends and mourned by America as its chief and most effective orator in the stormy days of protest and revolution. Bye-bye. See you next time.